I was in the office and left, so I went on in.
Why don't you go with the, when you, they set up your tent and you ate by yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
That wasn't too unusual for a chaplain because he's a counselor and a spiritual leader. But the men looked upon it as a segregation. And so then Colonel Schilling said, from now on. So I did.
So let's repeat that because we did lose the beginning of it. You protested about not being able to eat in the officer's mess because...
I didn't protest. I simply told the colonel that the men were hurt by the fact that I wasn't allowed in the officer's mess. I had to eat them myself. So that's when he got up and said that Chaplain Carroll would come in the officer's mess. No discrimination. And you know one thing? I think this marked the breakdown of segregation in the Army. And the reason I say that, we left Alaska, we left Alcan, you know, Fort St. John and Dawson, and went all the way to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. When we got to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana, there was strict segregation. No black officer, and only had a few, went in the officer's mess or the officer's club or whatever. But when the 95th got there, I was in the officer's mess, so I went on in. And with Colonel Schilling. And I think I was the first black officer in Claiborne to go in the officer's mess and go. So that's why I say that if the 95th made any contribution, it was at this point at Camp Claiborne, Alexandria, near Alexandria, Louisiana. And from then on. Then the next incident, if I may skip for you. The 95th was chosen to go to Europe. After we came from Alaska, we were in Claiborne, and we trained there only a few months. Really, I had sent for my wife to come down to see me.
But see, I've been away. You weren't supposed to go to active duty originally.
They were. Oh, yes. Well, you see, we were an engineer outfit, and we were to go to Europe to build installations for the invasion party. That's what we were doing, you see. And I found myself in the marshalling area. Let me get myself straight now. Anyway, oh, I know. We got on the boat, and the minute we sailed in Liverpool, the commanding officer, who at that time was Colonel Thompson, and he had a regimental conference, you know, call, got all the soldiers on the boat, and he said this, you wouldn't believe this, he said, now, men, we're in England, and there are no black girls here, so I don't know what y'all going to do in terms of your social relationships. So I said, oh, Colonel Thompson, that's the worst thing you could have said to the man. So the reaction happened what I thought. These guys said, we're going to show them, see. So I always use the technique of communicating, contacting the religious leaders in any community where we went. I resented the fact that the first people you see around when new soldiers come in, we're prostitutes, you see. And I said, I'm going to get the religious leaders. So I did. And, they were delighted, you know, to meet me. And I spoke here and there. I talked about the Negro in American life and how we were trying to overcome racism, how these people came out of slavery and all that sort of stuff. Because these folks didn't know about the system. Like eating, you know. So then I organized, you never heard of this, church parties. I would take, I've had as high as 400 soldiers march in the church. And I did that, and all the people were joyous. Now, we were in South Wales, Swansea. We followed a French-Canadian outfit. The French-Canadian outfit had made a terrible reputation. Now the people, they thought, you know, cause, so who are these folks, you know, they'd be. Okay, I was able to tell the soldiers, now listen, act like you really love this place, you know, and that you're glad to be here. They were genuine. And because of the contacts, you see, these church parties, a lot of people were inviting these soldiers, taking them home to dinner, introducing them to their daughters. That's right, they had dates. And thank God that well, we tried to do our best on sex education.
Well, you told me when you first were in that overseas and new to the command, you talked to the men, and the first thing you told them, I think, was I like that on the tape. First thing you told them was that they were downtrodden and they should rebel, and then you told them about the syphilis rate. Would you kind of repeat that? Mm-hmm. I think you're. Mike just went in the wrong direction. There we go.
Yes, we as children were very conscious of the venereal disease, and we entered into that with the medical officers to use protection, and we did the best we could. I would say that, of course, it's hard to talk about the moral life of persons, you know, soldiers. So then I sure were sexually active, very active. But a lot had relationships at home. They had girls, and I was very pleased with their conduct, really.
Well, you had a pretty low rate in your unit.
Yes. And I don't believe if we had any pregnancies that, you know, I didn't hear of any. We had one or two weddings.
In England?
Yep. If I remember correctly. But anyway, the men, well, one fellow dated a girl at the adjutant. And of course, he resented that tremendously. He had a black, he's in competition with a black fellow, you know. And I was saying in the group, I think I better be careful because when we got to Alaska, we had this situation of this fellow dating this woman.
What part was this round of?
Port St. John.
Yeah.
And some reason this had to, I had to be careful because he was a medical officer. And he got this woman to say that this fellow took advantage of her. I wouldn't say rape, took advantage of her. And after I talked a long time with the guy, and I believed him that he had dated this woman beforehand. She turned out to be really a prostitute. And that, I don't know whether she'd been paid to say this, but anyway, she reported it to this guy. And he was court-martialed. And I gave a character witness. And the court-martial believed me and got the guy off. Otherwise, he'd have been in very serious trouble.
Were there any similar events on the Afghan like that?
That was the only one I knew of, that, to be truthful.
And people in Alaska, these men weren't allowed near any towns or weren't in any towns, but in British Columbia, your men had plenty of chance to interact with the town people.
Yeah, this was in Fort St. John, British Columbia, yeah. And I did my best there to help.
Did you go to the churches there and organize parties too? Tell me something about your...
They had me preaching in some of the churches. And then I'm in this, you know, up in Canada, this co-op. And one of the members of the co-op was a minister of the United Church of Canada in British Columbia, up there, from Fort St. John, I guess. And he was the one that I had taken folks to church. So we know he just lost his son. He was a lovely guy.
Well, how long were you up there on the Alaska Highlands?
About 11 months, I guess.
And you went right through the winter, and you didn't just stay in one place. You traveled from unit to unit?
I, of course, based in the headquarters. Where was that?
Whitehorse?
Not Whitehorse.
Fort St. John.
And so I traveled the road with my recreation equipment and entertain the soldiers.
What kind of recreation equipment did you have?
Records.
What did you come up armed with? Did you buy it yourself? You got the Red Cross to furnish it? What did you do?
Oh, I guess the Army had it. We had our, now how did I get all the equipment? I thought it was just there, you know. I don't think it was the Red Cross. We had USO, too.
How much of a library did you bring up?
Ooh, I had a lot of books. In Fort Bragg, I had gotten in with the USO people there, and Marion, who was a woman there, was so much interested in us. She just gave us a lot of books she was interested in. So I just took them. So I had a lot of, paperbacks and records.
And what kind of records did you have? Everything?
Jazz. I had a few, Ave Maria, stuff like that. And I used some of these classical records when I dedicated the Sicknick Chief River Bridge. That got publicity. I guess that's where you saw Newberger.
Right. But let's put it on the verbal record here. Explain what happened when the Sicknick Chief Bridge was built.
Yeah. Experts said that it could not be built under a fortnight because of several factors. Number one was the lack of the proper kind of lumber. A little boy from Richmond, I said little boy, he was something. I don't know how they conscripted him, because he intellectually he was a retarded guy. Well, he was playing the wolves. I see him. Evidently he related to the wolves. He came to me and said, "Chaplain, there's lumber in the woods." He'd been up. I said, "How do you know?" "Well, I used to work with lumber people around Richmond, and I know lumber." So I said, "Well, show me." And we got the plans and training officer to go up there. And he said, "Chaplain, this guy's right." So he took a portable sawmill up there in the woods, and I got movies. Did I show you this?
No, haven't seen them yet.
I said, "Didn't I send it to
no,
you?"
No, you didn't. You sent them to Harper. George Harper.
Oh, well, I got a picture. I'm felling this tree. Felling this tree. And then taking the tree to the mill and getting the planks, getting it down to where we were building the bridge. And within a week, they completed that bridge. And I had a celebration by dedicating the bridge, setting my amplifiers up in the woods and putting Marian Anderson on. And it attracted correspondence. They came up. I don't know how the word got around it. Well, yes, here these engineers, the 95th engineers, broke the record. They built a bridge that was said could not be built without a fortnight within this time. So we had that. Oh, and they had the chaplain to put the last nail in. I almost missed it. It was something. And then I had an artist. He was a wonderful guy from Virginia State, Petersburg, who drew. Did you see it? Did you get that picture?
No.
You didn't. Mm-hmm. Walter Simon. By the way, he just died. He drew, made a portrait of the bridge.
Oh. Mm-hmm. What if he did the portrait of Jelly Johnson that Ma Mary had in the Alaska Highway newspaper office?
I don't know.
I've got a copy of that from the Fort St. John Museum. It's kind of like a charcoal sketch.
He would probably sign his name W.S. Walter Simon.
Mm-hmm. I would take a look.
Mm-hmm.
How cold did it get while you were up there?
I had a picture with Senator Neuberger when he was ordered by the Army to interview me as to what the Negro soldiers had done on Alcan, and it was 75 below zero. And the guy who took the picture says, good thing the wind wasn't blowing. They cut the ribbon.
You were there when they dedicated the Alcan Highway. Could you tell me a little bit about the dedication? It was
perfectly
awful day.
If I remember, yeah, I got a piece of the ribbon. You know, it's difficult. I better not, because it's hard for me to remember.
Okay. Do you have any kind of outstanding memories of the Alaska Highway beyond the sickening bridge, which I think is terrific, that kind of stick with you? Or any people that you remember, any one thing that we should put
down? Well, a couple of things. I went out on the trap line with one of the Indian guys, and that was interesting because I got a chance to meet people, you know, along the line. And I'd never seen a trappers, you know. And I thought it was awfully cruel, some of the animals they caught, you know, how it did. But he was a nice guy. He came around and I got to meet him, and that's how we struck up a friendship. That was one thing. The other thing, of course, was the dealing, when we first got up there, it was a spring thaw, and the muskeg, which you all call mud, and that was exasperating. Shortly after we got up there, let me get this straight now. You see, we got up there in March. Well, in November comes Thanksgiving, and I had a Thanksgiving service. Boys were very responsive. They would come out to church. Ever since I was attached to the 95th Engineers, I had a brass quintet, and two of the guys that played in there are here today, Irvin Smith and, of course, Trent. And I was preaching, you know, how grateful this is, Thanksgiving. And the way the boys looked at me is though they said, thank God for what, you know, and all this mud and loneliness. The only females up there were moose and bears and... So I tried to perk them up there. That was one of the things that I remember out of the loneliness. As a chaplain, I served, I hope, as a helpful counselor. They sort of looked upon me as mama, papa, girlfriend, everything else, you know. And I had a fairly good training in pastoral counseling at Yale. I used the non-directive method, you know. And the boys would come and I said, oh, so you feel so and so and so, and they would go on and on and on in that respect. That was very helpful because I think I let them get out a lot of the frustrations.
I think of you a little bit. You were raised in an upper class society, and your folks, including your mother, graduated from college, right?
We
were poor, but
and the minister was poor with life.
Right. But you had a chance of education, and a lot of your troops did not.
I sometimes
think of you as kind of an intellectual Peace Corps man going out into a world that you didn't know very well. I mean, had you spent much time with people who couldn't read or write before you went into service?
Not too much, you see, because I was in education. And most of the fellows were conscripted from Baltimore and Washington. Some were teachers, some finished Morgan, some finished Howard, some finished minor teachers college. Our regimental clerk, she was one of the top students at minor teachers college.
So you had a lot of educated men in your unit.
Yeah, but you see, the other thing was, core, the group that got the 95th started were old military folk, you know. A lot of them were illiterate and brutal.
They were white?
Black.
They were black, okay.
Black, you see, because that was another thing, you see. This is the black engineer outfit to get these old soldiers in. Mm-hmm.
How did you say
illiterate, you know.
Right.
You have to sort of...
it was the black men of the upper end, non-coms, I guess you call them, who were tough on the educated black people who came through.
It's like, you know, in the Army, you went through some rough times.
Yeah.
I don't care whether you were educated or not, you know, you were a recruit.
But what you tried to do was get some of those less educated people who were giving the new, young, educated people a hard time to kind of work together.
To work together, it went both ways, because the educated guys sort of besmirked and looked down upon these old, hard, you know, ignorant guys. And it was dividing us. And I didn't like that in our race. I think we need to help one another, you see. So that's what I was trying to do.
Did you get some people who came to you to write letters? And
oh, yeah. But most of it go to person. Most would go to... They're listening to my daughter sing.
I thought that was lovely. It was so eerie.
Oh, did you hear
in the up in the governor's suite when that music came on? It was
oh, you heard.
An unusual, surrealistic setting. Everybody sitting there, all dressed up, waiting. It was a nice thing. Could you put into? You've got more perspective, perhaps, than anybody here, because you went into the service with an idea that integration was possible, and a lot of people I talked to never dreamed there might be such a thing. I mean, that's why you went in, to raise a little hell, actually.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel the military thing? I mean, you know you cracked a barrier when you got into the officer's mess.
Mm-hmm.
And Camp Lebanon. Can you kind of put into perspective what World War II and the military meant mm-hmm. to you and maybe
yeah.
to the race?
Well, another thing, I think a contribution that I made, I was encouraging a lot of the men to apply to officer training, you see, because the highest officer we had in the 95th was a warrant officer. I'm sorry you don't know him, Mr. Sams. He was something. He's from California.
Is he still around?
I don't know. But he and I were chess players, and he was smart. He used to beat me in chess. But Sam's told me that the adjutant was not sending the applications off. So I happen to have known Bill Hasty, who was an aide to the Secretary of War or something like that. And I wrote to Bill a personal letter stating that the adjutant was not sending through. And he made it possible that we were investigated. So the applications went through. The colonel wanted to know how did Tasty know about this. The old chaplain wrote him. and the chaplain broke army rules, because when you send anything through the army, you've got to send it through chain of command. So I should have done it to the adjutant. Well, why give it to the adjutant? I'm telling on him. So I knew. And Bill knew too, you see. Okay. The colonel then said, well, now, chaplain, you have violated army rules. And you got to show reason why you shouldn't be thrown out. So then I called, I believe, my superior, who was the area chaplain, I forget. Anyway, he came down there to find out what's happening and discovered, I told him my story. And he said, well, you did violate the rules, but I think you did it for a good cause. And he recommended that I would be transferred out of the 95th Engineers. And I was. And I was transferred to the 502nd Port Battalion that was quartered in Glasgow, Scotland. And man, that pleased me because I wanted to get to Scotland. I was happy about that.
Of course, you had a mark on your record that you were a troublemaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you see, what happened was, another thing is that when we got into England and all, the colonel thought that I had stirred up the men because they got, you know, they... And the colonel was relieved of his command. Oh, that's what it was, Lil. I'm not true to my story. He thought that I had stirred up the man. And so when the colonel is relieved, he must rate his officers. And that guy took me from excellent all the way down to unsatisfactory. Well, when you get that kind of rating, that's what I'm talking about. You got to show reason why you shouldn't be thrown out.
Right.
You understand?
Right.
Okay. And that's when my superior chaplain came around and found out. And then he recommended that I be transferred, not thrown up. And that's how I got transferred to Scotland, which was terrific. I got a chance. There again, I reestablished, I got to know the Port Battalion folks. They were less educated than 95th. See, 95th was elite. And here, these guys, they were slinging, loading boats, you know.
And these were black troops, huh?
All black.
Yeah.
And the commanding officer, there again, you see, I got very close to the commanding officer. He was the editor of the Detroit News. And his father was Jay Hayden, the Detroit News correspondent in Congress. And, I tried to help educate Martin. Martin Hayden and I became very good friends. And we traveled over Scotland. One time we almost ran over a professor I had at Yale. It was an amazing thing. He was going across the street, Dr. Campbell. And we stopped and I introduced Dr. Campbell to my commanding officer. He invited us. He said, now I can't. This was a Sunday. And he said, Major didn't want my former student to know that I had the bad habit of preparing my sermon for this afternoon. So I can't invite you. But we had a great time. Also, there was a famous Scottish theologian who had taught at Union, and I had attended one of his lecture series, he wanted some nice coffee from the States. And my mother used to send me food stuff, So I asked Mama to send me some coffee. I got that and I took it up. Oh Lord, what a hit that I made.
And so you had some friends in high places.
In Scotland. Well, I had studied at Union in New York, and he was a visiting professor there. I'll remember his name in a few minutes, but that was another good contact. And we had, when we had gotten to Wales, of course they sing, you know, and we had in the 95th, a fellow named Sergeant Riley, these guys remember him, he was a baritone, and he could sing. He was trained by Todd Duncan, the famous singer around Washington, at Howard, he studied. So, we had a sort of a song fest in the Morristown Chapel, and Riley sang Sweet Little Jesus Boy, I'm telling you, he did. And the Welsh responded by, and the Welsh responded with a 200 voice choir, 4 manual organ. You haven't heard anything. It was something. It was the same church where a famous black musician sang. Now, what is his name? Toussaint Lenoir. Oh, God. Can't think. Anyway, we made history. We made history there. I was talking about at the time that Riley, you remember when we went to that tabernacle? We had a crowd, didn't we?
Oh, yes.
Now, they got over to England with you, even though
you transferred.
This is the 95th. Our pastor.
No, but you got transferred to Scotland, right?
Well, yeah, he didn't know about that, but no. I've gone back to Wales.
Oh, okay.
I've gone back to Wales. I'm sorry that I messed up, but this is how I flunk an interview.
Okay, let me just square that on the record. When you got protested and busted, essentially, you were already in England?
Yeah.
Okay. You went over, and then the 95th
then
went
I left
from the Alcan, and you all went together to where after you got through the Alcan?
Well, I left the Alcan and went to Scotland to an outfit that had been picked to go on the invasion of Normandy. So I was involved in the invasion of Normandy.
Right, but how the
95th? And 95th came over. Later they came over.
Oh, okay.
They were building road behind Patton. And I saw the boys, my old boys, and I told them, well, we got in trouble because we dropped Patton's stuff in the water. Mm-hmm. You know, he sent a general back to find out what had happened. To his clothes, you know, he was spotless.
Right.
And the 502nd Port Battalion had dropped his stuff in the water. We got it straight, though. Oh, but I was telling you about Major Hayden, you remember? We were unloading the ships in the invasion. And you remember it was a storm. And we couldn't get relief. So these men worked 24 more than that. So Colonel Major Hayden told the men, just rest on the ship.
On the pier.
And his superior came up and saw these fellows sleeping. And he raised Cain, get these men up here. And then got to work to the major tried to explain, well, these men had been working over 24 hours at times. You know what he said? Niggas can sleep standing up as well as lying down. And man, maybe I had trained Martin too much. Man, he lit into that officer, his superior. So you know what happened to Martin, to Hayden. He was relieved. But you see how these, don't get offended. But how these white folks look after him. He was kicked upstairs. He was kicked upstairs. And then another person relieved us. But I was so happy that Hayden took up our cause, you know. Yes, sir.
Well, we'll continue this at a later date. I'm sure we'll meet again, sir.
Because my